From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. French composer Claude Debussy made breathtakingly beautiful music that broke all the rules. It was tactile, mystical, sensual, irresistible, new. This hour on Point, in the 150th anniversary year of his birth, we're listening again to Claude Debussy. You can join the conversation. Do you go dreamy for Debussy, Clair de Lune, La Mer? What did he bring to music? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Salford, England, is Paul Roberts, pianist, writer, scholar of French impressionistic music. He's professor of piano at the Guildhall School of Music in London and artistic director of the international piano summer school called Music at Ambiolet in southwest France. He's performed and recorded Debussy's Preludes and Images and authored the biographies Claude Debussy and Images. He also has a new book out about Maurice Ravel, Debussy's French counterpart, called Reflections. Paul Roberts, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Very pleased to be here.
There's this story, maybe apocryphal, that you and others report, that the young Debussy is going about his business composing, and one of his teachers listens and goes berserk and says, "What rules do you follow?" And he supposedly, Debussy, the student, said, "I don't follow rules. I follow pleasure." What's captured in that perhaps apocryphal exchange?
I think it's near enough. I follow my pleasure. I think he's saying, I hear music in a different way. I no longer believe in tradition. He once said the dust of tradition is often not respectable. And he wanted to do things in a completely new way. And he already had a glimpse, even when he was a student, that he could do with them.
It can sound so impressionistic, like the counterpart to Monet and all the rest that was going on around this time, and yet he rejected that label. Why?
I think if you're going to stick your neck out and say that you're doing something new, you don't want any labels to be associated with you. One formula is replaced by another, and I think this is what he was setting his whole being against, being pigeonholed. He actually said impressionism, symbolism, useful terms of abuse.
Oh, I love it. The guy had a way for words in addition to music. And we'll look at that music, Paul Roberts. Give us a little sense of the biography of the man. Where did he come from? What kind of family? He's got a reputation as sort of an irascible guy. Give us a sense of his life on the biography side.
Yeah, really interesting. There's a very interesting story about Bartok visiting Paris when Debussy was at the height of his fame. And his hosts asked him, what would he like to do? And he said, above anything, I would like to meet Claude Debussy. And his host said, but he is not a very nice man. He will simply be rude to you. And Bartok said, yes, I want Claude Debussy to be rude to me. So the irascibility is true. But there are two sides to Debussy's life and two sides to his character. The irascibility came because he hated the limelight. He hated the fame that came to him after the premiere of Pelléas et Mélisande. In his early days, as a student, as an unknown bohemian artist in Paris in the 1890s, he was a very different kind of person. He was fun. He was a great mimic. He was loved by his friends. It was said that he could be, and all his life too, a very loyal, very sensitive friend. But when the limelight came, he retired into his shell.
And there he could be as irascible as he liked. 1862, he was born, of course, 150th year we're now in. Died in 1918. Here's a little bit from one of his earliest, again, here comes this tag, impressionist works. Arabesque number 1, Andantino con moto, I guess. composed 1888, 1891, first arabesque, marked the start of his rule-breaking, wandering in and out of keys and modes. Let's listen a little bit. The pianist here, Walter Gieseking, 1953 performance. Paul Roberts, there's rule-breaking going on here, but it's funny because we can listen to this quite easily today with no sense of a rebellion or revolution going on. Sounds very, very smooth and nice. What was the upheaval underway here?
This is very interesting. The piece you were also playing at the beginning of your program, the Clair de Lune, which was actually orchestrated, which he also wrote solo piano. Both these pieces, particularly Clair de Lune, you know, Debussy was inclined to disown. This arabesque we're listening to now, it's early music, and it contains very strong traces of his originality, yes. But what is going to be interesting throughout the course of this hour, I think, is to hear how Debussy broke away from this early style. And I think when we get to his later music, when we get to La Mer, symphonic poem, when we get to the later piano music, we're going to hear something very different. Let me say, this is built on pentatonic procedures, this piece, which were certainly not unknown. The Russians were doing it. And in fact, there's some wonderful music by Liszt, some late Liszt, which uses pentatonic scales. So Debussy knew his history too. He wanted to escape tradition, but he was steeped in it, you know. He knew his Mozart, he knew his Bach, he knew his Schumann, and he played them all at conservatoire. I mean, he went to conservatoire, Paris Conservatoire, at the age of 14 as a pianist, and he really got to know music from the inside.
Well, let's push it on then. Let's go just a few years later. I think here's the prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, celebrated piece inspired by a poem, composed, one really highly regarded piece here. This is a Cleveland Orchestra 1993 performance. Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Famous, famous, well-known music here. That wandering, dreamy sound. Where's he headed, Paul?
Now, this really is the great masterwork of his early years. This comes a few years after the arabesque and a few years after Clair de Lune. And this is an extraordinary work. It's very difficult to completely put your finger on it. I mean, now, from our vantage point, some 130 years later, maybe 120 years later, it sounds perhaps like late Romanticism. Pierre Boulez said that in the flute of the Faun, music started to beat with a new voice. And it's not only the harmonic procedures, the extraordinary way that Debussy manages to keep the music from resolving. He keeps it floating. This is the dreaminess that you've identified. But also in the exquisite use of timbre, exquisite use of orchestration, there's a lightness, there's a gossamer-like texture to this music that is really new. And there's a sense in which there's a wonderful youthful idealism too. And another thing to say about it, very importantly, and this is characteristic of Debussy's greatest art, and this piece marks the point of it, is that it shows an extraordinary association with words. The Mallarmé poem, The Afternoon of the Faun,
drawn from,
it is inspired this piece, and Debussy is showing a response to text, a response to the meaning, but also the sound of language, which is extraordinary.
In the Flute of the Faun there, Pierre Boulez says, and he's conducting, of course, the Cleveland Orchestra behind us right there with the prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Paul Roberts, it's so great to have you with us. What a treat to be able to just sit back, listen, sample through here, and see the evolution of this great composer's, French composer's, work over time. Paul Roberts joins us from Salford, England, author of the biography, Claude Debussy. We're talking about the man and his music in the 150th anniversary year of his birth. You can join us this hour. Do you know Debussy, recognize him, love him from Clair de Lune, La Mer, his sort of watercolor music, Monetian music almost? And do you hear how he broke the rules, the structure of classical composition, composed from the heart? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Paul, please stand by. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Debussy. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're listening back today to the dreamlike, misty music of the great French composer, musical impressionist Claude Debussy in the 150th anniversary year of his birth. You can join the conversation today. Do you know Debussy? Love him? Do you hear how he broke the rules? And whatever he thought of the term, do you hear an impressionist at work here? Do you hear the ocean, the mist, the sea in his La Mer, see the moonlight in Clair de Lune, the Faun in his Prelude? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK with pianist, writer, scholar of French Impressionist music, Paul Roberts, who joins us today from Salford, England, biographer of Debussy. You can read an excerpt of his biography at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul, what are we listening to right here?
This is the opening of Pelléas et Mélisande, the masterwork of Debussy's life, really, although I think one can say it's the masterwork of his early years. He was still a young man. And it is an extraordinary tour de force, because in this work, and with Afternoon of the Faun to prepare him, in this work he escaped the gravitational pull of the mighty Richard Wagner. And yet the paradox is the opera is imbued with Wagnerian procedures, but used in an extraordinarily personal way. This is the great work of Debussy, and it repays enormous study. Not immediately approachable in the opera house. It's not one of the great popular operas, but for those who are prepared to devote a little bit of time to Debussy, the riches awaiting listeners here are extraordinary.
I want to look at that love-hate relationship with Wagner, but if I may, we've got listeners calling in. Paul, Judy in Quincy, Massachusetts. Judy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just amazed at this conversation, and I'm getting kind of really choked up as I'm listening, because I grew up playing classical piano, and when I was in my early teens, I first heard some Debussy, and I basically forced my teacher to let me learn Debussy, and I learned all the children's suites on the piano. And for me, Debussy is just embedded in the fabric of my DNA. I have it represents independence and emotion and love and passion and all those things. And I still, you know, it's funny, just I recently picked up Clair de Lune. It's like that's the piece that everybody first learns, and I'm at 53 years old just learning it now and reconnecting with Debussy and the great love that I have.
Judy, I'm struck by the word independent, the word independence that you use. What do you mean by that? Independent-minded as a composer or something else?
Independent-minded as far as he broke the mold of all these other classical composers. I think when you learn classical music as a child and you're playing, you know, Beethoven and Bach and all this stuff, and it's all very regimented. While you still have all those rhythms and you have to pay attention to that in Debussy, you also have this breath of fresh air and this feeling like this is something that's so different from everything else. And you know, I'm an artist, a professional artist now, and I really connect with that level of creativity and his just breaking away.
Judy, I'm so happy for your call. Thank you very much for that, and keep on playing. Paul, was he received that way at the time? Was he seen as somebody turning things over, breaking the rules?
Oh, yes. Not without enormous criticism, of course, and not without a lot of resistance, a lot of envy, and a lot of complete... no response to his music at all. There's a lovely remark by Saint-Saëns, who was a real bête noire of Debussy's as well. Saint-Saëns, in some letter to a friend, said, Debussy merely had a name with a euphonious sound. Had he been called Martin, no one would ever have heard of him. I mean, what a great put.
What a dig. Wow.
Yeah. But amazingly, there were really discerning critics and friends and composers for whom Debussy was the god. And anybody in the avant-garde at the time, and not only musicians, painters and poets too, were extraordinarily aware of what he was doing.
Greg writes into us online. He says, I love the romantic era music of giants like Chopin and Liszt, but Debussy, he says, in my humble opinion, took it to another place. He said, many consider him an impressionist, he writes to us, but he never jumped over the cliff. The harmonic structure was unpredictable, in many cases unresolved, but somehow the melodies and harmonies created tension instead of dissonance. Let's think about that for a minute. The tension instead of dissonance. Paul Robertson, Salford, England, please stand by. With us as well right now from New York is conductor and music director for the St. Louis Symphony, David Robertson. He's in New York rehearsing for the upcoming performance of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro at the Met, at the Metropolitan Opera, starting at the end of this month. He's conducted works of masters like Satie, Schoenberg, Dvorak, and Debussy. David Robertson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What's it like to conduct Debussy, as in the whole world of composers you conduct? What's singular here?
Well, I think one of the things that impresses you is the extraordinary, sensuous beauty of Debussy when you're conducting him. There's nothing like doing the opening of the Prelude to the Afternoon of the Faun, mm-hmm. and having the flute solo, bringing the woodwinds in, and then having that first string chord come in. It is so luscious and so rich and so perfectly placed with all of the notes just where they should be, you know, for literally the physical laws of the overtone structures, that he follows that up with a full bar of silence, which is an extraordinarily striking thing to do, but is perfectly adequate given that what you've just had actually can't be followed by sound. It's too beautiful to be followed by another chord. So it's kind of like he says to the audience, okay, everybody, let's just take a moment here.
Yeah, right,
and then we'll move on.
Just savor that for a moment. Does Debussy draw a line through your musicians, David? Are there some who are wild to play him and others who are no thanks or not?
You know, I think Debussy requires enormous concentration and control on the part of musicians, mainly because the music is oftentimes very subtle. And so there are people who look forward to a performance of his opera Pelléas and Mélisande with great joy, but they understand that it is an almost Zen-like undertaking at times, where you need to create atmospheres of just an otherworldly beauty, and yet at the same time, that is done by sometimes sustaining notes very softly or playing scurrying passages with a lightness as though the orchestra's feet never touched the ground. And this is something that you have in many, many works of Debussy. And so the longer they are, the more you find musicians who are either very enthusiastic on playing them or would rather do something else with their time.
Let's listen to just a little more from Pelléas and Mélisande here, Act 4, Scene 4.
Ce que tu sais déjà, tu ne sais pas ce que je vais te dire.
Pelléas saying, you do not know the reason why I have to leave you. You do not know that it's because I love you. He kisses her. I love you too. We've got romance. Oh, Paul, how was this opera received when it first came out?
Well, that is an extraordinary moment that's just about to come up, by the way, before I answer you specifically on that question. I mean, to score Je t'aime aussi, to silence is quite an extraordinary thing. I mean, imagine what Wagner would have done with that. He's done it. I mean, in Tristan, the passion, the sexual hysteria is in the music, and it's huge. These two are frightened, timid, and the music stops when he says, I love you. And then when she says, I love you too, there's just one low, unaccompanied, unadorned note underneath her, and then silence. Well, I mean, it's quite extraordinary and very deliberate.
Let's put it right up against that Wagner. I've got the love duet from Tristan and Isolde here, Wagner's, and my, what a difference. There's the Love Hate Master, Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. And, of course, they come to this duet singing, Then am I, myself and the world, floating in sublime bliss. But, David Robertson, it is entirely a different texture from what we just had from Debussy.
That's right. And, when you've conducted both operas, both are glorious in their own way. And what I think is fascinating is that Wagner's music was so pervasive at the end of the 19th century. And this is when Debussy is coming of age. Mm. And so he was also caught up in the wonder and beauty of these things, went to Bayreuth and saw the holy shrine of Wagner's music.
Yeah.
But his reaction was to understand that, certainly for himself, there was no way to continue in this type of path. And it's interesting because it is true that the lines of, I love you too, in Pelléas seem like an anticlimax, but musically we've been aware right from the beginning that these two love each other enormously. And whereas the Wagner tends to illustrate the emotions very clearly with the music,
yes,
what Debussy chooses to do is to have oftentimes very small and seemingly almost haphazard statements where the musical subtext underneath lets us know that Pelléas and Mélisande are combined by their and, just as much as Tristan and Isolde are combined by theirs, that they are a single unit, and the love that they share is so deep that it surpasses words. And I think this is one of the things that, made Mallarmé so jealous of Debussy,
yes,
was that he was able to be so extraordinarily specific in his musical language, and yet not have to necessarily refer to things of a prosaic nature. And I think this is where Debussy constantly surprises us with sounds that we half expect, and yet when they arrive, they're both extraordinarily satisfying and surprising at the same time.
Let us take it, if we may, to the sea, La Mer, here maybe his greatest orchestral work. This is the Montreal Symphony Orchestra with the first movement from his 1905 Ode to the Sea, La Mer. Debussy's La Mer. Paul Roberts, our listeners write to us one after another about the power of nature in his work. Dawn and dusk, landscapes, mindscapes, mind in dreams, mind in wonder. But nature he goes to again and again for such a direct symphonic experience of it, Paul.
In music, no greater response to the elements or to the sea than this piece. It's extraordinary. And yet, you know, one of the early critics, and Debussy was absolutely furious, but retained his cool and wrote to him very politely afterwards. One of the early critics said, "I neither see nor smell nor sense the sea in Debussy's La Mer." But, history has overruled that. And I think this is justifiably one of the great popular pieces in the concert hall. It's been recorded so many times.
David,
one of the supreme works.
Yeah, David, do you feel him, hear him accessing nature here because he was prepared to move away from traditional rhythms and somehow have a more direct expression? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, I think you're onto something there. I think what he's listening to are in a sense almost the deeper rhythms of nature. And in La Mer, there are very clearly passages in which he has the whole orchestra undulating like some extraordinary wave on the surface of the water. But he's extremely good at finding sometimes very, very small groups of notes, intervals, and putting them together in such a way that they end up being almost like brushstrokes of an impressionist painter, where when you look at an individual one, it doesn't seem to mean all that much, and yet the cumulative effect of this is overwhelming to our aesthetic sense and to our emotions. And I think that this is something that he recognized in nature, is that you look at a single flower and it is extremely beautiful. You look at a whole field of poppies and the sense is overwhelming. And Debussy treats his orchestration with that type of care and detail of someone who's really making sure that every effect, however subtle, every choice of instrument, every choice of which position in the sound that instrument plays its role, all of these things are done in a way that up until that time, no one had quite grasped just how the physics of sound will allow music to open up. And this is something where many of the 20th century composers really point to Debussy as their starting point, as someone who allowed them to hear music in so many different ways, because there is this openness. And it's whether it's not even just the orchestral works, it's also in the chamber music pieces, whether it's the trio for flute, viola, and harp, or whether it's even in the very late pieces, the sonatas for violin and piano, or the cello and piano, where there are sounds that are just amazing.
David Robertson, it's a privilege and an honor to have you with us for a few minutes today. I know you're busy preparing The Marriage of Figaro there for the Met in New York, but thank you so much for joining us today. It's really, really wonderful.
Tom, you're one of my favorite programs on NPR.
Bless you. David Robertson, thanks so much for joining us from New York there, conductor and music director for the St. Louis Symphony. Paul Roberts, please stand by. We are listening to Debussy today. You can join us, listeners, 800-423-8255. Was this the man who teed up jazz in the midst of all this, who found the chords that cleared the way? What's your response to Debussy? 800-423-TALK. Paul Roberts, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're listening back today to the often dreamlike, nearly mystical music of the great French composer, musical impressionist Claude Debussy in the 150th anniversary year of his birth. Paul Roberts has joined us from Salford, England, author of the biography Claude Debussy and Image, the piano music of Claude Debussy. You can read some excerpts at our website, onpointradio.org. He's just out with a new book about Maurice Ravel called Reflections. Check it out as well. So great to have him with us today. Behind us right here, Preludes Book 1, Number 12, Minstrels, performed by our guest today, Paul Roberts. You can join the conversation today. Whatever he thought, whatever Debussy thought, do you hear an impressionist at work here? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Paul, you're a pianist. What's it like to play this?
Extraordinary. I wanted to catch up on or add to what, or confirm what David Robertson said. I mean, about the extraordinary subtlety of this man, every note in the right place, amazing textures, amazing sensuality of the music. And I thought this sounded a bit like me. Yes, it's me playing.
Yes.
This is extraordinary because you've mentioned that Debussy is sort of prepared the way for jazz. Perhaps not quite, but Ravel did that very much too. Mm-hmm. And Ravel was more into the jazz era. But this particular piece we're hearing, Minstrels, is actually a response to some American music, early ragtime, cakewalk music, that Debussy had heard by street musicians.
Oh, I could hear that right at the end, just before it stopped here. I could hear a little of that ragtime now that you say
it. Yeah, absolutely. And there's another great piece in the Preludes, in the second book of Preludes, called General Levine, who was an American clown. And Debussy manages to get ragtime into that, too.
Well, that's great. Let me get a caller right here, if I may, Paul. And wonderful playing on your part there. Steve in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Steve.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to extend the connection, I guess, between Debussy and jazz. Obviously, he was not a founding father of jazz, but he heard ragtime and other kinds of American music, and he definitely had an influence on people who were composing kind of hybrids in the 20s in jazz, most especially or best known Bix Beiderbecke, whose series of trumpeter, but also great piano player and composer of pieces for the piano, probably his best known being In a Mist, which carries a lot of the, especially harmonic influence, whole tones and other stuff that Debussy used. And Bill Challis, who was also a well-known arranger in the 20s and influential, and also black arrangers who made use of some Debussy devices.
Steve, may I ask, do you play jazz? Do you play Debussy? Do you play both? What's your instrument?
Well, I play trumpet. I play a little bit of piano, and there are some simpler pieces by Debussy that I can play, but I've always appreciated his music as many jazz musicians have through the ages.
Steve, stick with us. Paul Roberts, how about it? Not a founding father of jazz, but yet an influence that jazz, American jazz musicians in their own turn picked up on.
Hugely so. Bill Evans, I mean, certainly was steeped in Debussy and Ravel. They discovered harmonies, they discovered new sounds, they had discovered the upper reaches of the dominant chord, the 11ths and 13ths. I mean, not exactly discovered them, they'd been used in the 19th century, but used in a new way. Debussy's voicings, his textures, and the sheer sound has had an enormous influence on jazz musicians.
Steve,
some jazz pianists sometimes. I teach some classical music at my school in London, and we spend our time filleting Debussy and finding out these wonderful chords that they're able to name for me in jazz terms.
That's great. Steve, what have you played of Debussy on your trumpet?
You can play transcriptions of things like Afternoon of a Faun and Preludes. But I was going to say the big three probably for jazz musicians were Debussy, Bartok, and Stravinsky. Those are the three people that people most talked about during the development of 20th century jazz.
Yeah. I'm so glad for your call. Let's hear a little bit more of the Preludes. This is Book 1, Number 2, the vowel, the sails in English, Debussy.
Thank you.
Performed there again by my guest today, Paul Roberts, in his 2006 film, Mists, Fairs, and Fireworks. Laurie's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Laurie. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to say that, like all of your callers and like every right-thinking person, I love Debussy. But, you know, even though I can see where people might consider his music romantic, what grabbed me right from the start with him is how modern it seems. I get the eerie impression whenever I listen to Debussy that he is looking right at us, that he's saying, it's 1890, but I'm looking at you. What do you hear, you know, from
yes.
my time? I'm representing my time to you.
Yes, as if he's tipping right into our age. As if he's tilting right toward us there, Laurie.
Yes, I feel his gaze very strongly, and just that little undercurrent of anxiety seems very turn of the century, just... He's very aware of where he is, and that there'll be something after him is the feeling I get.
Oh, I'm right there with you, and I especially hear it in this piece. Paul responded to that, this kind of romance. Yes, you hear it in the background, some pieces, earlier pieces, heavily, but right here, just tilting toward the modern, and as Laurie says, as if he's staring us right in the eye.
It's a brilliant image. I'm grateful to Laurie for that. That's exactly what he appears to do. And this piece, of course, is built on whole tone scales, which are not our usual major and minor scales in Western music, which accounts for its special quality.
Just beautiful. Just beautiful. Laurie, thank you. Dana in Barnstable. Thanks for calling, Dana. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you, Tom and Mr. Roberts. I'm a real Debussy fan. I'm a musician as well. And I'm also a fan of someone who I think influenced him to some degree anyway, especially the later works. Franz Liszt's later piano pieces when he was very old are definitely pointing to the future. And one of them called Gray Clouds, or now is Gris, I guess that's the way you pronounce it, uses that, sort of hints at that augmented interval and sort of, I guess, hinting at the whole tone scale. And Debussy described this piece, as so did Stravinsky, as beautiful and perfect.
Paul Roberts, how about it? The Liszt,
yeah.
Debussy connection?
Absolutely. Very, very important. Both Liszt, both Debussy and Ravel were enormous admirers of Liszt. And Liszt's harmonic language, which was extraordinarily advanced even in the 1830s. And your speaker there was talking about a piece written in the late 1870s, late 1880s. Mm-hmm. Even early in the century, Liszt's harmonic language was very advanced, and Debussy learnt very much from that language, that particular language. And I think also Liszt was one of the first to experience the possibilities of atonality in his compositional technique, in his writing. Now, Debussy isn't atonal, and I think one or two people have raised this, two of your callers, about the nature of Debussyan harmony. I think if people can't relate to Debussy, it is for the fact that we're used to music that has a direction and a fundamental gravity, and Debussy's harmony doesn't do that. It doesn't resolve. It floats. And this can be very disturbing for people. It's not atonal, but it doesn't have the direction that classical music has, classical meaning,
right.
Sort of the Beethovenian kind of style. It doesn't have that kind of architectural structure which grounds you, gives you a sense of security and faith that you know what's going on. With Debussy, that is withdrawn from you, and you are just without any flaw underneath you.
Fantastic. Let's go to Clarksville, Tennessee, and Ken. Ken, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, sir.
I just wanted to say that when I listen to Sirens by Debussy, that I get a kind of a... I try to image something a little different, I think. I try to see the ships that are wrecked on the rocks and the dead sailors and all that kind of macabre sort of a thing.
From Odysseus?
Yes.
Yeah. Does it take you there? Well, we'll ask Paul. Is our caller Ken? This is the Nocturne, what, 1899 or so?
Yep.
Sirens.
Yep.
Is he picturing what Debussy might have hoped?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've overused this word, I'm sure, already on this program. Yes. But it's extraordinary music, and it has that wonderful unaccompanied female chorus, doesn't it? Which would be very typical of Debussy, to get within the very texture, the very fact of the music, he gets the female element, because of course the sirens are these wonderful creatures sitting on the rocks who lure sailors to their death in the Odysseus tale. So absolutely. And Ken, I feel the same as your caller. I can pitch myself there too.
Ken, you're right there. I don't have that one, but here's a little image. This is "And the Moon Descends on the Temple." It almost falls apart, but of course it doesn't. But it gives it so much air.
Those crunchy harmonies, I mean, it's exactly what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen to this. That forlorn melody with those bells underneath it.
Yeah.
And there's no anchor, you see. We're not going towards a key center.
No.
We're experiencing the sort of the sensation of the sound at the moment.
It's just breathtaking. Frank in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on the air.
I use it, WC, totally differently. I had chronic pain for 40 years, and by laying down and deep breathing and listening to him, I'm able to sail away for 10, 20 minutes at a time away from this achy body and just get away from it.
Oh, there's a blessing all in its own. You float with him, and it's a mercy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Gosh.
And I guess only Debussy could do it.
Yeah, maybe.
For the very nature of his harmonic structures.
Yeah. You know, we've got something that maybe, I don't know if it's applicable or not here, but I do have something, almost his final work. This was composed 1915, as Debussy was dying in pain from colon cancer. This is the sonata for cello and piano in D minor. Benjamin Britten and Mstislav Rostropovich there. Where was he pointing here, Paul?
This great period of 1915, when he was in remission from his cancer, he produced the greatest music of his life. He produced these three wonderful sonatas, the cello sonata, violin sonata, flute, viola, and harp. He said he had rediscovered music. He hadn't written anything for about 18 months. He had been grievously ill. He had been operated on. He said he rediscovered music and discovered its beauty as if, for the first time, music had never been more beautiful. And also he wrote the great 12 studies for piano, which are one of the monuments of piano literature of the first part of the 20th century. Where is he pointing to in this particular sonata? There's an extraordinary use of texture, of sound again for its own sake, new kinds of sound. And very interestingly, he pitches the cello against its usual nature. You're not really in the presence of long, soaring cello cantabile lines a la Romanticism, but he demands an enormous amount of the instrumentalist to get a different kind of texture, sonority, feeling into the music. Can I just say also, he said of this sonata that it was Piero, he said, angry with the moon. Now, Piero being the lovesick clown who is always put upon, loses the girl. And Debussy is saying, no, Piero is going to fight back.
Gosh. Did he feel that he had taken music somewhere by the end of his life? That he'd
Absolutely. I really think he felt he had fought back in this particular 6-week period. I think he felt he had overturned the German ascendancy that had peaked with Wagner and Mahler and Strauss. And I think he thought he had something of equal importance to say. And history has absolutely agreed with him. I mean, I think Debussy is even more in the ascendant today than he was.
There's a gentle triumph for Debussy. Paul Roberts, it's been an absolutely a joy to spend this hour with you. You're so generous with your insight and so rich with insight. We just
can't thank you enough.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much for being with us today, Paul.
Well, I would like to say as your other speaker that yours is one of my favorite programs, but in fact, I don't get it in England, but I'm sure if I listen to you...
Pop online.
yeah.
You'll find us.
I think my family are listening to me online right now,
good.
So I will learn to do that.
Our best
Thanks,
to all
Tom.
Of them. Paul Roberts with us from Salford, England today, author of Claude Debussy. We'll go out once more with Claire de Lune, performed here by the Jacques Lussier Trio. What a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.